there we go.
Before you start, are you like the very earliest students in Lancaster?
No.
one of the earliest.
I'm not the earliest. No, the earliest in 1960s.
I'll right?
Get
there.
By the time
they started 70s.
No, started 60s. I'm 75. It was 10 years old by the time we got here.
Oh, okay.
I mean, it was a campus university when I was here, not in town.
Right?
Now, okay. Probably the best thing is to go through a history and talk about several, because I've been involved in both entrepreneurship and entrepreneurship. And if you don't know the difference, it's actually a really important one. Entrepreneurship is creating novel things within a large structure, which is a whole different process from being an entrepreneur. So I kind of like being in both, right? So by way of history, I came up here to read physics and philosophy, which was an indulgence when I decided to do it, but has proved very useful since. At the end of the year, when I went over to philosophy completely, I was here for 4 years because I was student union off general secretary for a year full time. And for those of you who don't know, 75 was the year of the big occupation, so I was one of the 25 expelled. And reinstated it thanks to the intervention of the Privy Council, because we proved the university were guilty of illegality. So we had a lot of fun in the 70s, all right? Either way, after that, I worked on the programme to combat racism, working out of Geneva. So I was working on Aboriginal land rights in Australia and was actually doing some of the auditing of the refugee camps around Zimbabwe, which was pretty formative, to be honest. I remember having an Aboriginal activist killed in front of me by my own security guard. And we went to the police and we were told it was only an abo. Yeah, and we were taken out of territory. But the really scary thing is nobody in Geneva would listen. Because what was going on in Australia was genocide, whereas in South Africa it was a sort of form of tribalism with racism overlaid. Right? So one of the things I've been arguing in Labour Party circles for the next general election is that we should really have one thing you might want to consider doing is actually giving free education to people who will spend 2 or 3 years doing something in the world and charge anybody else full fees, on the basis that if you go out and actually see different cultures in that sort of 18 to 21 year period, you can't come back with a sort of classic British, you know, fog in channel, English cut off nonsense, right? So either way, so that's part of the background, right? Either way, I ended up with a philosophy degree, 3 years of working in charity, and I was a Jesuit for a year before I failed the test for obedience, which is the story of my life. So I had to get a job and ended up in HR, which was an interesting experience in the early days of computing. So I actually learned computing by actually playing around with computers and writing things, and was self-taught in that sense. And then went to be a decision support system consultant, and that was when I created the first internal business, because nobody up till that stage had seen computers as providing decision support shipped to leaders. Right? So I created a whole new enterprise around that within a company called Data Sciences. We then did a management buyout, and that's one form of entrepreneurship, which is actually quite scary. So 50 of us bought the company from Thorney MI. And 2 to 3 years in, 5 of us went to tell the venture capitalists the truth, and the next day we were the only 5 left. And the company went down to a penny a share. We spent 3 years turning it around, and then it was sold to IBM, and that was unexpected. We actually thought we were floating the company. IBM phoned us one night, and 3 days later we were sold. Now, I wanted to make one general comment of that. Having C-level experience is extremely useful if you want to do really novel things. Yeah, I've been a general manager. I wasn't allowed to be a general manager until I'd done a year in sales, a year in production, a year in support, which actually meant that was hugely valuable, because I knew what it was like to not be able to make the mortgage payment because I hadn't made a sale that month. And once you've lived through that, you don't treat salesmen people the same way. I also know if you've been on the support line, you can't take the average length of a call by the average number of calls divided by the available man hours and come up with a staffing plan. Only somebody who's worked off spreadsheets will do that. Yeah. And one of my major concerns, and you'll see with the latest enterprise I'm running, we're trying to challenge this, is we're allowing people to do business studies followed by an MBA, followed by working for a large consultancy firm, and then moving sideways into management with no real experience or no real understanding, and you get management by spreadsheet, which is a major problem in large corporations. Yeah. So either way, that's, you know, going through something where you're not even sure whether you can pay the wages for 2 or 3 months is actually a very useful experience. It sort of keeps you focused in that sense. Either way, IBM bought us, and then that becomes a completely new challenge. I created a thing called the Genus program, which had combined rapid application development with object-orientated code, with legacy management. That was pure marketing spin. Yeah, there were the three dominant needs in the market, and we put them together in one coherent narrative. And we were the first company to did that. So it became 80% of our revenue. And we were sold to IBM for $96 million, which was twice what we were actually worth. Yeah, but that became IBM Global Services. If you know the history of the computing, that's now 50% of IBM. Yeah, so they were buying things in different fields, and that was the early days of computer services. Either way, that made me, I was in a strategy role by that time, and I was just allowed, and it was wonderful, to just do what the hell I wanted in IBM. It was kind of like, you know, here's some staff, here's some resources. No, you can't have any more resources unless you get somebody to pay for it. Go and do what the hell you want. So I made a decision then that, and one thing you realize, if you've done physics and philosophy as a joint honors, it teaches you to despise social science from two completely different disciplines. And I haven't got away from that since. And management science as a subset constantly confuses correlation with causation. If you look at business MBAs, these days they're all case-based, which I think is a total disaster. So somebody goes and studies 20 companies who they deem to be successful. They're always the same American companies, and it seems to support every available management fad, but nobody questions that. And then they identify things that these companies do in common, and from that they create a recipe and say, do these things, you too will be successful. Right? Well, the fact that 20 successful American manufacturing companies have CEOs with regular bowel movements, it doesn't follow that your recruitment strategy should be based on observing the toilet habits of MBA students when they come from interview, right? You've got a correlation, but you actually haven't got a causal link between the two. Yeah, and that's actually really important. So we sort of said, you know, that's a real problem. Because as the world becomes more and more uncertain, you've got fewer and fewer cases which will repeat in the same way. So actually trying to use the past to inform the future is an ontological error, let alone an epistemological error. Sorry, I'm an academic now. So we said what we need to do is to actually go back and for the first time since the 18th century do a reset on social science from natural science. So we just said forget social science, forget management science. And we went to cognitive neuroscience. You know, if you don't know it, the most you scan of what's in front of you is 3 or 4%. And you make decisions based on a first fit pattern match on about 40 to 50,000 patterns based on recent experience. If you actually, famous experiment in this, you give a set of x-rays to a bunch of radiologists, you tell them to look for a cancer nodule. On one of the x-rays, you hide a picture of a gorilla, which is 48 times the size of a cancer nodule. 83% of radiologists on average do not see it, even though their eyes scan it. Yeah? Now, if you think about it, that undermines every qualitative research method that anybody teaches in any university automatically. And it actually gets rid of any idea that executives can pay attention and get the right decision because you won't see what you don't expect to see. Yeah, a complex adaptive system in which I've made my name, I got, I think, 2 of the 50 most cited articles in their field, in that field, is known as the science of uncertainty. It deals with systems where the future is unpredictable and is inherently unknowable. Yeah, therefore, the only thing you can do is manage the present, and trying to manage a future state is a fundamental error, which undermines things like scenario planning because that restricts what you see within the future. Yeah? So either way, I started to work on that, and we also started to realize that you needed to map in real time. So linear-based approaches to market research were again a fault. And one of the things you learn pretty fast in business is you have a good idea and you commission market research to prove what your idea was. Yeah, this idea that you do a logical market research and then come up with a rational plan just doesn't, you know, you won't survive if you do that in business, all right? You go with your gut feel and you use MBA students to prove data to prove your gut feel after the event. That's how you write business plans, right? And anybody who tries to tell you it's more rational than that is a fool, right? Yeah, that's the way it actually works. So we said, let's start to recognize this. And one of the things we know is that the fundamental decision process that people make is through what are called micro-narratives. So if you want to understand how people work, it comes through the day-to-day stories of the water cooler, yeah, the school gate, the checkout queue. that fundamentally patterns the human brain and that filters how people see things. Yeah? So I was working on that. By now I was running a thing called the Institute for Knowledge Management within IBM. And I got phoned up by the CAA, which was a bit of a shock for a former Catholic Marxist. I used to lead the Catholic Marxist group at Lancaster, and nobody stood a chance. You know, we had religious and political discipline. We ruled campus for 3 years, right? So it was a rather shock to be phoned up by the CAA and discover the CIA were members of our institute, right? And so after a few awkward conversations, I agreed to go down to Arlington. Met a guy who I didn't know who he was until I decided I liked him, and then I discovered he was Admiral John Poindexter. If you know your history, was NSA to Ronald Reagan, and a good Welsh Catholic Marxist is not meant to like a right-wing Republican, but he's still a personal friend, a very bright guy. And they pulled us into starting some pioneering work, which is carrying on actually at this moment, on pre-radicalization. So gathering micro-narratives to understand the preconditions which actually allow people to choose to become terrorists. And as somebody, if I'm perfectly honest, first time I was in a police cell for civil disobedience, my family has a tradition. My daughter has let the side down. She's the first in six generations not to have been in by 18, was in age of 14 in Derry, when Catholics didn't have the vote. And if I'm quite honest, that generation of us, I think I can think of three nights where I almost joined the IRA, almost. And anybody in that period will tell you the same thing. Now, if you allow people to get into that hopper, really bad things happen. And we're now working on the peace negotiations in Colombia. And the story we're trying to tell is not you became a terrorist, I didn't, but there for the grace of God went I. Because if you don't change the way that people talk about the past, you can't create a new future. And that actually applies in marketing consumer products as much as in peace and reconciliation overall. Yeah? So either way, we got involved in that. I was in the Pentagon the day before 9/11. I flew overnight back and then picked up the news the next day, and then it got kind of like really serious. And we've done works, and this is the product we then created called SenseMaker. So for example, we pulled in 50,000 stories across Pakistan within 1 week. We had 40,000 came in from immigrant areas in the UK. We proved conclusively that radicalization was going from the UK to Pakistan. Yeah, and that sort of work has continued. That was a fundamental way of informing it. That work has now gone on to the development sector. So for example, we're doing work on sexual abuse in Rwanda, where we got young girls who've been subject to genital mutilation and rape who are now acting as field ethnographers to gather stories of people at risk in their own community. And because they're describing their situation, this is a quantitative technique in a qualitative domain. That's the really original thing we did. Yeah? Quant in qual. What's interesting is cathartic for them, but when we look at the way they interpret the data, it opens up multiple opportunities for intervention. When we give the same data to development experts in Washington, The Hague, and London, ask them to interpret it, it's a narrow interpretation based on an evaluation. And therefore, the opportunities for intervention radically change. We've got the same working with Roma in Eastern Europe and elsewhere. In fact, we now dominate development sector in terms of this. So that concept of description, not evaluation, and of a real-time sensor network, you know, totally changes the way you do marketing. So for example, we've got big companies like Boeing, like Intel, like Ericsson we work with. We're using their consumers and their employees as a human sensor network. This is kind of like works with the Internet of Things, but is actually contraposed against data analytics. I do not buy data analytics. The most you can write down of what you know is 5%. So anything which works on text interpretation is strictly limited in its value. So we're using human sensor networks together with machine sensor networks. So for example, in social work, we're now moving social workers keep continuous records in return for not writing reports. That allows us to look for patterns over multiple reports in real time. But it also allows us to trigger what are called anticipatory alerts, which means a social worker will be basically a trigger mechanism will say the plausibility of abuse means you should stay in this house and ask questions. Because in a complex world, you can't forecast an event, but you can trigger what's called anticipatory awareness. Yeah? So the software product SenseMaker is kind of like the latest business I created. You know, I left IBM 12 years ago. I think we're one of the only software companies that have ever done 10 years without any capital investment. And that was quite deliberate because we were creating a market, not providing a product for a market. Right, so going through some lessons from this. There's a key thing from biology called dominant predator theory. So when an ecology is disrupted, so you know the meteor hits the earth, dinosaurs get wiped out, if you had to predict who the next predator would be, you'd probably go with the shark or the crocodile. You wouldn't go for the first mammal. Yeah, so when you get radical disruption, something completely novel emerges, it becomes the apex predator, and then the rest of the ecology organizes around that predator, and the predator survives no matter how incompetent they are. So in the 1920s or 30s, IBM becomes the dominant predator and survives despite massive incompetence for decades afterwards. Yeah, then the ecology shifts from hardware to software. Guess who comes in? Microsoft. And then the ecology shifts from software to ecosystem. Apple comes in. And to be honest, Apple are the next IBM. They're going to dominate the next 50 years. Nobody's anywhere near that. And Google have actually given up on competing. In terms of ecosystem, they're competing on individual products. So if you've got a completely novel market, you can establish something with something small. If you're in the established market, you feed off or feed the dominant predator. And that's kind of like lesson number one if you want to create a business. Is it radical disruption, in which case something small can consolidate the market, or actually is the market stable, in which case you have to feed whoever the dominant predator is. Right? So kind of like one lesson on that. Yeah. Secondly, I would completely forget business plans and visions. The reality is, and I think I loved your presentation, but you dealt with the reality every day. It's kind of like, you know, so I'm looking behind you actually, but you as well. Yeah, because you weren't further, because basically you're managing, in complexity it's called, you manage the evolutionary potential of the present. Yeah, so you need to scan accurately as opportunities emerge, you shift them forward, you see what works, and you do small experiments in parallel, you don't do one experiment in sequel. Yeah, that's kind of like a key lesson on that. I mentioned the sea level thing. I've had many employees over the years, and I've learned two key lessons. One is employ people who are at least as bright as you, if not brighter, and who are mavericks, and subject them to a deep end test. If anybody has read Swallows and Amazons, you remember there's this wonderful telegram at the start which says, if not duffers won't drown, if duffers better drowned. So my strategy with any new member of staff is to throw them in metaphorically into the deep end of a swimming pool, go and have a cup of coffee, and the ones who are still swimming when you come back are worth working with, right? If you're a small business, it's brutal, but it's actually better for you and it's better for them. If they can't cope, if they need supervision, it ain't gonna work, yeah, in a startup type thing. And I think you also have to accept that some people will betray you. I think that's been one of the hard lessons. I would never have a partner with 50% shares again. And I should have known better because all the cases are bad. Yeah, but if somebody does betray you, you've just got to learn to live with it. Yeah, and you've got to move on and move on from that point of view. So, kind of like summary. At the moment, I'm running two businesses, Cognitive Edge, which created SenseMaker. I'm now moving that to, in fact, I'm looking for a new CEO for that, and we're now moving for investment. Because what we've done is we created a whole new market for micro-narrative with self-signification. So we're now creating a net promoter score business, a 360-degree feedback business, an employee satisfaction business, each of which is, we're now looking for venture capital to create multiple small businesses using the core concepts. But it's taken us 9 years to get the market ready for that. Then you look for investment. Yeah, if you have venture capitalists, and I know this because I've had them, before the market is ready, the pressure on you almost destroys what you're trying to achieve. But what I've also done, which is just set up, is a new center for applied complexity at Bangor University, which is in my home, which is North Wales. And that's got several programs. It's going to do the R&D, but we're looking at vector measures. Outcome-based targets will destroy the health service if we carry on the way we are. We've got about 20 projects running in NHS Wales, all of which are focused on measuring direction from the present and speed of travel, rather than theoretical outcome. Yeah? We're also building a project called Children of the World. The World Bank will hopefully fund this and in negotiations, in which every child at the age of 16 to 18 in every school in every country of the world will go out as a citizen journalist into their communities every month to gather narratives into a quantitative framework. and that's designed to counter social computing. And this may be controversial, but social computing is now the problem, not the solution. It's become the tyranny of the herds. It's a new form of mob rule. So what we're looking to do is to create a sensor network which can provide objective feedback, but to inform government in real time. Yeah? And with that, we've got some other interesting programs in edge economics. My next article in Harvard is an all-out attack on Adeo as having industrialized design. Yeah, so we're now talking about complexity-based design thinking. And the final thing, we're creating a new MBA at the moment, except it's not an MBA, because if it was, we'd have to consult the business school, and of course we're not. So it's 2 years of 101 courses in philosophy, anthropology, biology, physics, chemistry. We're still working on the list. 3 residential weeks to do the new sciences, and you apply what you've learned from the humanities and sciences to business problems over those 2 years and write a thesis. No cases. Because what we're trying to do is to create a new generation of generalists rather than a collection of recipe-based specialists. So kind of like, final lesson in all of this, all the way through my life, I've done what felt right at the time, and it's worked out. And that's kind of like a really strong recommendation.
Yeah. Variables. I know that this is kind of a new topic for you, especially in countries in conflict, as for example is Colombia, but have you had the opportunity to measure the error or the population models or the models, the mathematical models that you are using for predicting future?
Yeah, well, we're using fitness landscapes, yeah, from evolution in biology. So if somebody tells me a story, they interpret it onto 6 to 8 triangles, mm-hmm. method we developed and patented. The triangles have symbols or words which are all positive or all negative, so you don't know what the right answer is. That's where we get the quant. Then we can look at probability distributions, so you end up with effectively a fitness landscape in which the hollows represent strong opinions, but you also see the outlier events. And then you get this key concept of complacent, the adjacent possible. So if I've got a negative attitude towards FARC in Colombia, there's no point in trying to get people to an idealistic future state. In fact, Peter Senge and I have had some... I can't stand Senge or Sharmiga, right? If anybody likes them, they're post-colonial. They've decided what people should be. They're not letting people be what they want to be, right? So I'm very much into small actions in the present. So you find an adjacent cluster, and you sit down with people, or you get them to do it themselves, and you say, okay, what can we do tomorrow to create more observations like this and fewer observations like that? And that's a new theory of change. You don't create an idealistic future state, you shift the present. Yeah? And Colombia is really interested in that at the moment.
Yes, actually, it is a kind of interesting topic for me. Yeah. The conflict there has been for nearly 50 years.
Yeah, I know that, and I've been out in the jungle on some of that. Last time I got shot at where a machine gun was on that. But, yeah, it's interesting. The other thing we've done in Colombia and also we're doing in Cape Town is how do you get entrepreneurs who will stay in the poor areas rather than use government funding to get out of the poor areas and make the poor areas worse? And that's a big area of work at the moment. It's critical, and the French government have done all the wrong things. So this goes back to constructor theory in physics, right? So you look at what does natural law say are the limits of what's possible. Then within those limits, you say, what's the lowest energy cost of replication? Now, the problem is ISIS has a very low energy cost of replication. It acts like a retrovirus, whereas Al-Qaeda had quite a high energy cost of replication. So if something has a low energy cost of replication, the last thing you do it is hit it with missiles because it will break and propagate faster.
No? Yeah, it's the highest funded network that's ever been known.
The funding and the control is distributed. That's the other point, all right? And I mean, ISIS was predictable from Al-Qaeda, and sorry, there's something that I can't, the next stage on is even more scary. Right? And you can see the early signs of that. And that's a fully distributed thing, which is ideation-based, not physically based. All right? And if the West carries on reacting the way they are, that's going to happen sooner. Yeah, because if you don't change the underlying ecosystem to make terrorism less likely, yeah, I mean, I come back to think, you've got to stop things getting in a hopper. The minute people are radicalized, terrorism will happen.
I'm very excited that you mentioned about the MBA. MBA course, you said that...
It's not an MBA, no, it's definitely not an MBA. Definitely not an MBA.
Anyway, yes, you said that everybody has to become a generalist.
Yeah.
Can you repeat that,
please? Yeah, and I think one of the problems we've got at the moment is people have become too specialized. So if I go back to when I was at school, all right, we did exams at 16 and 18, which gave us time to think between it. I mean, my kids do a module a term, well, they're university now, and they forget things once they're in the module. The other thing is, certainly in Welsh grammar schools, every week you had to stand up in front of the class, you'd be given a card, and it would say something like, you support capital punishment. And you had to speak for 7 minutes without preparation on something you profoundly disagreed with. And we did that every week from 11 to 18. That meant you read everything, but you didn't know what you're going to hit. And it was very useful as convener of debates at Lancaster because we had the biggest budget for alcohol, so it paid off at that point. But the point is, you need people who can synthesize different knowledge bases. And education is not throwing them out at the moment. It's throwing out deep specialists who can't see a bigger picture and can't synthesize different disciplines. So if you're taking that, there's a famous book, Thinking Fast, Thinking Slow. I mean, it's classic. I mean, the economists give Nobel Prize for nothing, all right? And they don't. But he only had to walk across the corridor to his cognitive neuroscientist colleagues to discover we knew that stuff 10 years before. It's called autonomic novelty receptive processing, which is an easier explanation. Yeah. So this constant siloing of knowledge bases and the lack of integration is very dangerous in a world where we need synthesis fast.
Yeah. I'm very excited because I do a similar thing all of my own. Like I read like a philosophy book, neuroscience yeah.
You're not one of those bad editors on Wikipedia I have to deal with on the philosophy article. You just check it out. Wikipedia is good training for complexity science. Right?
Yes, so I read them and yeah. sort of put all these ideas together and to form my business. And then
yeah, and I think natural science is going through massive change at the moment, which actually means you don't have to be a deep expert to understand a lot of it, because a lot of it is so. No, it's like epigenetics. If you don't know it, okay, if you give bright mice. The children of the dumb mice to bring up, the children of the dumb mice are bright.
Yes.
Because it's chemical activation or deactivation of DNA. All right? And symbolic evolution in humans drives DNA change. Now, once you realize that language is changing DNA, then that actually tells you an awful, it comes back to the terrorism issue. That's the concern we got. The language we're doing is creating DNA, is creating actual biological change. It's no longer a symbolic change. Yep.
Which is they're able to be. They talk about their businesses and business plans and the rights and wrongs, but that was my kind of take out. They've all trusted what they've felt themselves about the situation or that person, and they've tried to be themselves.
The other thing I'd encourage is none of us built our businesses to sell them. And that's what worries me. I do a lot of work in the Valley at the moment. I mean, the trouble with California is that they read Ayn Rand and think she's a serious author, which is really scary, right? But at the moment, the general attitude, if you haven't made a billion by the time you're 25, you're inadequate. And they're creating companies to sell, not creating companies to create a sustainable economy. Yeah, and I think, you know, that there's, you know, at the moment, incubators and reverse incubators are making the same mistake. Yeah. We need people who want to create sustainable businesses.
Fascinating.
artwork. Please come have a look at the works in progress.
A lot of my views are actually views and my views are very important. Yeah, and that's why I feel okay if I ask it for it. The way you express
it. I always answer it sometimes.